This is the weekend edition of the Daily Gold Podcast, covering precious metals and global capital markets for intelligent investors. Now, here is your host, Jordan Roy Byrne.
Welcome back to the Daily Gold Podcast. I hope everyone is having a great Easter weekend so far. This is being recorded on Friday, and today the jobs report came out. There were some positives in the report, but the headline number was a huge miss. Only 126,000 jobs were created. Economists, on average, were expecting 240,000. And we also learned that good news from the previous two reports was likely overstated, and as those figures were revised. In addition to that, Fed funds futures now show the first rate hike to be in December, and also there's only a 66% chance of that. Now, markets are closed today, or were closed today, I should say, except currencies, and on the news, the euro surged higher, and the U.S. dollar index initially lost more than 1 point, but recovered some of those losses. Metals markets were closed today. Gold closed Thursday at 1202, so perhaps it tests that 1220 resistance early next week. So keep an eye on 1220 and 1240 as resistance targets. Meanwhile, the S&P 500 closed at 2067. That's 2067. It's only 2.5% away from its 200-day moving average, so keep an eye on that level. It's something that could be tested next week. Anyway, on this week's show, we have two interviews for you. The first is with Greg Weldon, who we haven't had on in about a year. Greg provides comprehensive research on global capital markets as well as money management. In my opinion, out of all the analysts that cover precious metals, Greg is the best when it comes to analyzing the macro picture and its effect on precious metals. In our interview, Greg discusses precious metals, commodities, and the effect of Fed policy on currencies and precious metals. You can find Greg at WeldonLive.com. Next, we have a new guest. He's Jesse Felder, who worked for one of the largest firms on Wall Street, and then he co-founded a multi-billion dollar hedge fund firm. He discusses his views on U.S. equities, the bond market, gold and gold stocks, and a few other markets. You can find his work at thefelderreport.com. Now, coming up next is our interview with Greg Weldon. Welcome back, everyone. Now we're speaking with Greg Weldon, CEO of Weldon Financial, one of the favorite guests of the show. Greg, starting off, in your opinion, what do we need to see technically in precious metals to lead you to believe that the bear market is over or just about over?
Well, I think if you want to get your most robust technical confirmation, let's focus on the price of gold. I think it's pretty, frankly, pretty clear cut. 1307 is a critical high that was reached. If you take a look at a weekly chart of gold, it's quite evident that a move above that level would violate many long-term indicators that have been in a bearish trend. You would have already have violated the 52-week moving average. You would violate two-year moving average with a violation of, let's call it 1310, along with a very flat downtrend line that goes back to the first upside retracement relative to the big collapse in gold that, you know, broke the back of the market. So from that perspective, I think it would be very technically significant on a longer-term basis if you were to eclipse that high. It's actually 1307.80 on the continuation chart. Not only that, but within that same context, you have, if you were to break out above that level, you would leave behind in your wake a very well-defined Fibonacci retracement pattern relative to the entire bull market going back to 1999-2000. So I think that that's really interesting. The 50% retracement of that bull market was at 1090. You got to a low of 1130, and you have kind of a double bottom off that low. That's a pretty compelling technical math that would suggest, again, that a breakout above 1310 would have not only short-term but also medium to longer-term technical significance.
Yeah, the 50% retracement there below 1100, that's been a level I've been looking at. But we talked about technicals. Now let's get into fundamentals. What catalyst or change do you think we need to see in fundamentals to support a new bull market in precious metals? Is it something changing in the economy? Could it be more radical policy from the Federal Reserve and other central banks? And also, do you think gold can begin a new bull market before, I mean, months before this type of fundamental change could take place?
Well, that's a pretty loaded question, and I think I've probably got three or four answers to that one.
We can hear them all.
let's start with a simple top-down, real secular fundamental change that I think is occurring very, very slightly and very, very slowly. But the degree to which the environment has mutated against gold in this sense that I'm about to discuss, it's so severe, it kind of boggles the mind. And that is very simple. The thought process, or at least kind of the hypnosis, if you will, that the Fed has perpetrated upon the markets into the belief that risk does not exist anymore, that there is to be no volatility. We've squelched both, okay, risk and volatility. And, you know, the Fed has very successfully done what they exactly wanted to do, which was force people out of safe assets, bonds and gold, and put them into risk assets, i.e., in this case, risk assets being U.S. stocks, to circumvent a collapse in the stock market that might have, you know, not allowed any recovery in the macroeconomy. You know, we can argue all day long about the macroeconomy. I'll tell you this, it's improved, but it's still dysfunctional. Case closed. It's not repaired, it's not healed, it's not healthy. So from that perspective, you are reliant on the Fed. And this is why you see markets kind of reacting the way they have to the taper turn tap out. Now, that might be another fundamental that you need to see a shift. So the first one would be, you know, if you had some kind of downside action on in stocks, if the Fed were to make a policy error here, and I would consider it to be an error, if they were to tighten policy by raising rates, that could precipitate a rally in gold that would be predicated upon a return of a demand for some safety against risk. But that doesn't necessarily have to happen for the environment to change in a positive way for gold. To me, and we've discussed this, you know, for quite some time, you know, it is a currency-driven market right now. The dollar has rallied predicated upon Fed tightening that may not occur. It was 18 months ago that the markets were telling us today, by today, the Fed would have tightened four times already, raised rates by 25 basis points in four different occasions and raised rates by 100 basis points in total. By today. That was the belief 18 months ago. So, you know, whether 18 months from now we meet the levels that the markets have provided, which are below levels that the Fed has provided, okay, that's pretty interesting. So within that context, if the dollar rally were to become unhinged here on that thought process, that could provide a boon to gold and to precious metals. I think that ties in better on a intermarket basis, on a technical basis, on a timing basis, as a thought process that could be a catalyst for a change in the mindset around gold. Having said that, you know, that would take some potential, you know, divergent moves, as it were, that gold would have to diverge kind of from currencies. In that context, that leaves the third answer, which is commodities in general. And this is kind of where it gets kind of cool. Because if you think about the collapsing crude oil prices, wow, did this gain a lot of publicity and attention? And oh my God, collapsing commodities, what does this mean about the bigger economy? Oh my, you know, well, you know, the metals and the metals mining shares peaked in 2011, broke down in 2012. The, you know, the bullion, the physical metal prices followed in 2013. They were the first to go. And you've had a rolling bear market in commodities ever since. You had iron ore go. It actually made new lows in here today, literally. You had rubber, stuff like rubber go. You could take a whole slew of industrial commodities. You can take the grains, the oil seeds. They rolled over whatever it was 18, 24 months ago. And then, you know, finally, when it's crude oil, it gets so much attention and focus. I might say that this rolling bear market in commodities is closer to over than not. not saying it's over, but I think there's a good chance that, you know, the metals may show us if they were to break out here. And, you know, you've had some indications in some short time frames in the last few weeks where the miners have done, you know, better. You've seen that in petroleum as well. I don't know that petroleum is bottoming, but if the dollar is peaking, petroleum could be bottoming, at least on a medium-term basis, for big corrections. And that might provide enough impetus to get gold to break out as a first stage a year, 2 years, 3 years from now, leading commodities, you know, in a bigger picture thing on the flip side of what we just saw develop out of 2011 and 2012. So I also kind of see some interesting things going on in some of the agricultural commodities that might tie into that and actually give us some confirmation. Cotton is one of them, wheat, soybeans. So there's a variety of ways in which this might morph into a more friendly environment for gold.
And Greg, I just want to follow up on a couple things you touched on there. Those two things would be, one, I think you mentioned the stock market earlier in your answer. You might agree or disagree with me. Personally, I feel like gold and gold stocks have to break out against the S&P 500 and kind of reverse the capital flows that have just been, you know, going into stocks and going out of gold and other hard assets. And secondly, with the dollar, I mean, it's kind of perverse thinking, but I want to get your thoughts on this because I don't know. I mean, if the dollar breaks out and surges again, it's kind of, I could be wrong, but I feel like at some point that would become a global issue where central banks would have to come in and say, you know, we got to do another Plaza Accords or whatever. And perhaps maybe that's the reason why gold has yet to make a new low, even though the dollar has really been on fire. So I know there's a couple things in there, but can I get your thoughts on those?
Well, to go back to the stock market, it actually ties back to your thought on, you know, what if you get another surge in the dollar? I mean, you know, I think to answer the second part first, the surge in the dollar has actually created opportunity. And I mean, you know, you can say, hey, gold was just about to break down through its low of 1130 here, but gold in Brazilian real is making a new all-time high at the same time. So that drives home the point that this is a currency dynamic that is going on right now. It's not about gold. It's about the dollar. It's about the damage that theoretically Fed tightening could do as reflected by the response in the dollar predicated upon, you know, widening in interest rate differentials that's driven by Fed rate hikes. It's that simple. This is the play. And that this would be very detrimental to the commodity countries, the exporting countries like Brazil. They have their own, you know, indigenous, you know, dynamics too that don't help. They exacerbate the problem. But you can take a number of countries. I mean, it's not just Brazil. They're all over the place. We did our piece, our 2014 outlook last year, January of last year, was called Peso Wars. And it was about the depreciation of currencies that was going to take place in South America and Eastern Europe, including Kazakhstan and Georgia and Ukraine, before there was a military conflict. This is bigger picture stuff predicated upon what if the Fed were to tighten monetary policy. And you see the reaction in commodities, new lows. You see the reaction in places like Brazil, new lows. You know, the currency gets trashed. Interest rates go up. This now, again, link back to if the dollar were to go to new highs, it would absolutely be in some kind of, you know, issue globally. That would be the risk metric would return, and you would think that that gold might be able to de-link from the dollar and rally at the same time. But that is where you want to really kind of have some diversity in your gold holdings relative to different currencies. Now, back to the stock market, because that's a really interesting little wrinkle. If, let's say, that the Fed continues to kind of backstep, you know, in their expectations for GDP growth, inflation, and the Fed funds rate going forward, which is what they just did, which is why the dollar has wobbled here, okay? If they were to continue to do that, you might think, guess what? That should be bullish for the stock market, right? And that might preclude some desire to hold gold. On the other hand, what I think could happen in that scenario is that you already have a lot of liquidity right now. So, I mean, it's not a liquidity issue for sure. There's no shortage of liquidity at the moment. Okay, this is all about psychology. But if you were to add more liquidity at some point, there might be, you know, a thought process around the gold shares, the mining shares. These are heavily undervalued assets. And this could be a case where they outperform the stock market just because you get flow into an undervalued assets as opposed to going out and buying what might be perceived as overvalued tech assets or biotech or healthcare or consumer discretionary, all of the things that have been upside leaders. Now, that's a stretch, and I think that's a lower probability scenario than the ones we've been talking about. But that would be interesting, and if that were to start to develop, I'd have some thoughts around that.
Greg, another thing I want to follow up on is just more radical policy from the Fed and perhaps other central banks. I mean, obviously, the QE has been really radical, particularly from Japan, as we know. But do you think the economy could get to some point where just the deflationary forces that are still present, I mean, put policymakers in the U.S. and in a position where they have to do something more radical, like, I don't know, maybe negative interest rates for people. You know, maybe when the new president comes in, they put people back to work with an infrastructure program, and maybe the Fed monetizes that debt. I mean, another guest mentioned that. Can you talk a little bit about what you see potentially down the road if we go that route of more radical policy where they say, all right, we have to get the money in the economy. We need inflation now.
I think that the potential for that is quite high. And I say that because it's always quite high, and it has been quite high for years. And it, you know, just continues, because every time you do this, if you want to have the same impact, you know, you have to spend exponentially more money. This is the problem. This is one of the issues of, you know, it works until it doesn't work. It's like poker. You can go all in, even on a bluff. You can go all in with pocket aces. You can win going all in, you know, every time until you don't. And when you don't, you're busted. So this is part of the problem. And I think that the Fed is acutely aware of this. I think the Fed is acutely cognizant of the fact that they may face some serious issues down the road. Chicago Fed President Evans did a speech, and we highlighted this in our Weldon Live last week. It was unbelievable, and the phrases and the syntax that he used really kind of caught my attention to the degree of they're thinking, what if we hike and we shouldn't have? They're thinking Sweden, okay? They're thinking, what if? We're sitting here waiting for inflation expectations to become more embedded in the consumer and the business mindset, and we're missing the fact that disinflation expectations are actually becoming more embedded. And when I say that, the evidence mathematically is pretty robust. And what I mean is, if you take the Fed surveys and you look at prices received, you get a six-month forecast, you get a current reading. Six-month forecast 6 months ago stated, I believe this was Philly, but you've gotten Philly, Richmond, and what was the one we just got? Philly, Richmond, and Dallas. All three produced very similar, excellent, detailed data. I believe this was actually the Dallas Fed. 6 months ago, 36% of firms said they expected to be raising finished goods prices right now. Now it's 6 months later. It's a new low in the percentage of firms actually raising finished goods prices. It's 7%, and it is half of the firms that are cutting finished goods prices, which was virtually zero 6 months ago. From that perspective, you can make a hardcore case that disinflation, deflation expectations, at least in the manufacturer, the finished goods seller, are becoming more embedded, not inflation expectations. Pricing power expectations have continuously failed to have been met, and they are failing right now in a big way. And this is part of the reason that, you know, you do see some push in wages, but it's not broad-based and probably not sticky enough, primarily for this reason and primarily because, you know, there's still a ton of unemployed people out there that are not counted, not looking for jobs. You're not producing enough, jobs to really take down. Participation rate against the unemployment rate tell two totally different stories. That's dysfunction, bottom line. So from that perspective, you could see very radical Fed policies, because guess what? The participation rate and the unemployment rate are two wildly different stories, and this is exactly what they're facing. And just to finish this off, and getting back to Charles Evans, because this was phenomenal stuff, he spoke of the Chicago Fed inflation model, which has been the most accurate predictor of inflation that they have had, and especially when other things were saying inflation was going to go up, this said it wouldn't, it didn't, and that was from 2013. It predicts that the PCE year-over-year rate of inflation will be no higher than 1.6% as far out as 2021. So if that's the case, you better believe the Fed's going to be breaking out some radical policies in the next 6 years. They're going to have to.
Right. Now, let me follow up just with a question on inflation. How much of that do you think is because of the collapse in oil?
Clearly, a good deal of it, and that makes it even more interesting, Jordan, because you have math in play now on a year-over-year basis going into the summer where you're going to start to leak the deflationary impact of the decline in oil. So it's actually obviously pushed inflation down, particularly in Europe. It's been a boon, by the way, to countries that import, you know, oil, obviously, and in many cases has masked declining exports in a lot of places. So, in fact, in my mind, it is actually, you know, the decline in commodities has been a problem for emerging markets. Yet the decline in oil has provided some relief for emerging markets, and it has masked what might have been even more volatile currency moves. So if oil were to go back up, that could bring that currency dynamic right back into play. That's number one thing you got to think about when we talk about that. But in terms of you know, just getting back to the forward inflation thought process, that is kind of mathematical. That will work its way out. I think that's a bigger issue for Europe than it is the U.S. But still, when you look at inflation numbers, they have been pretty broad-based in terms of the disinflationary dynamic. It's not just oil. It's a lot of things. It's, you know, you need to see turns in a lot of things before you're going to have any kind of incipient type of inflationary risk, in my opinion. I mean, could it happen? Absolutely could happen. No doubt it could happen. We're on alert for that. I mean, always. We haven't seen it, and we don't see any signs of it. Not yet.
So I guess, I mean, this is an open-ended question. So I guess it comes down to, I mean, we know that disinflation is bearish for precious metals and hard assets, but If the disinflation becomes deflation, that forces policymakers to react, and so that becomes bullish for precious metals. Or can the disinflation morph into rising inflation, even if it's coming from a low level? That would be bullish for precious metals. I mean, is that basically what it comes down to, that we're seeing disinflation now, and it's a question of which way is it going to go? What would you say about that?
I would say absolutely, and I think the bigger picture question within that question is really important, and that is, has the breakdown in gold and iron ore and oil and grain, has the breakdown in commodities and the run-up in the dollar, has that been a signal that central bank policies are not working as well as they were in 2009, 10, and first half of 2011? That is probably the biggest picture question that people don't ask. I don't know the answer to that. My gut reaction is absolutely. And from that perspective, it still suggests they have not done enough to spark inflation. Now, could that change? I mean, it absolutely could change. Could we get another round of commodity inflation? That's deflationary on the macro economy and causes the Fed to do something dramatic. Absolutely. That would be a nice little twist, wouldn't it? There's let's just put it this way, Jordan. I've been doing this for 31 years. I've been doing it on my own for 18, heading into my 19th year soon. I can tell you, I mean, I wrote my book in 2006. We called for a credit issue in the U.S. where the Fed would buy trillions of dollars of debt, you know, monetize debt, and asset prices would go crazy, and gold would, you know, rally. It was trading 500, 450 to 500 at the time. We go to 1,200. We were wrong. It went to 1,900. We got laughed off the set at CNBC for suggesting that the Fed would buy treasury bonds, literally, in 2006. I can tell you it's never been harder to prognosticate, to figure out what's going to happen next. All you can do is say, you know, create all the what-ifs and look at the data every single day and dig deep. And this is what we do, and this is where we actually have a business thanks to this, because we provide this service of digging deep and getting all these little metrics every single day, because it is the most complicated puzzle of all time. And you need to gather as many pieces as possible to have any chance of putting together enough to figure out, you know, where to go.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just a quick follow-up on that. Can you predict that the Fed is going to buy stocks in the U.S. at some point? I mean, Jim Grant had a hilarious quote where he said, the Japanese central bank, they're the leaders in policy failure. You know, they're the ones who are there. I think they're buying Japanese stocks. Do you think at some point the Fed is going to be buying stocks here in the U.S.?
I might suggest that a lot of people would say they already are. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm not a conspiracy theorist guy. I'm a conspiracy believer. So there's always conspiracies. Oh, my God. I mean, everything's a conspiracy. They've been active in intervening underhandedly in the markets since I've been into business 31 years ago in the Florida COMEX. So I take that as part of the business. Will the Fed openly buy stocks at some point in the future? I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of our tenants back in 2006, we said that, you know, someday the Fed could very well, you know, push the monetary Armageddon button. And they have that button there. They flip up, you know, they get the keys in and they do the whole thing that you see in Hollywood in terms of, you know, setting off nuclear weapons. Okay. And the monetary Armageddon button is when they are pushed back to the wall, where they have to buy every treasury bond ever printed, okay? They have the capacity to do that. So could they buy stocks? Sure, they could buy stocks. And, you know, they could do all kinds of things. This is, for me, going all the way back really, you know, to 1998. I mean, 1991 was the last recession prior to this most recent one where you had any debt pay down at all. So you went through 98, 99 crisis, 2000, 2001 tech bubble. You know, we had no debt pay down whatsoever. It just kept growing debt, which is what led to 2008, 2009. But, you know, from that perspective, they have continuously been creative and been surprising in their aggressiveness as it relates to monetary policy, monetizing debt, and keeping this bubble from, you know, crashing, because that's what it is. I mean, it's the greatest bubble of all time, but at the same time, you have the greatest blower of hot air keeping this bubble alive. And this could go on for a lot longer. I mean, it really could. This is where it's like there's probably no end game. It's not like there's rampant reflation or, you know, devastating debt deflation, okay? There's more of both, and there are more swings, and there are more of this uncertainty. And at the end of the day, it's a lower standard of living in ways that people don't even understand, you know, with the polarization of wealth, because that's really what keeps happening. And at some point, you know, you have social issues. You have all kinds of thought process around that. I mean, you know, we get into a whole nother universe of conversation when we take this to the next step. In terms of, you know, will the Fed buy stocks? I mean, that's kind of a minor question relative to the bigger questions of, you know, well, what's the world going to look like if and when we get to the point where the Fed's going to buy stocks?
So last question quickly. So the fact that gold has had this really long bear market, does that just, I mean, in your opinion, does that set up gold just for a long-term investment, buying it here? Does that set it up just really, really well?
I got to say, Jordan, I don't look at it like it's had a really long bear market. I mean, you can certainly say the mining shares have gotten, you know, filleted, devastated, demolished. But if I look at the price of gold and I take it back to, you know, literally 1979, 1969, 1971, this is an ongoing bull market. You can make a very, very solid case that this is an ongoing bull market that has had a normal correction. From its high of 1920 to its 1130 recent low. And you can map this out on a variety of Fibonacci ratios, going back to the 2008 low, going back to 1999, and going back to 1971. Until proven otherwise, that's my view. And I think that that is the secular view that has merit in the bigger picture of what we're talking about here, because the Fed can want to hypnotize us all they want to suggest that they've removed risk and volatility. But anyone that is sophisticated enough or has experience enough or who has a brain can figure out that that is not necessarily true and, in fact, is not at all true. So from that perspective, I think there's still going to be demand for safety out there. I think this is still the primo place for safety, dollar and U.S. bonds notwithstanding. And I think that will be borne out over time.
Okay, Greg. As we close, can you please tell our listeners where they can go to follow your work, how they can get a free sample, and how they can subscribe?
Yeah, absolutely. Weldon Live, WELDON, WeldonLive.com is our relatively new website. We offer research there. We offer channels. They're videos. They're daily videos. We cover six sectors: fixed income, foreign exchange, stock indexes, metals, which is precious and industrial, energy, and the agricultural commodities. Those are the six channels that you can purchase and subscribe to with a daily report on those, including specific trading recommendations. And with that, with the purchase of any channel, you get our macro service as well, which is really what people love, which is the top-down type of analysis we're having right here, which is a video that is sometimes 2, 3, 4, sometimes even 5 days a week. It's, you know, it's bigger, and it's whenever I can produce it. I do all the work myself. So you can go there, sign up for a 3-week free trial, and, you know, go from there. We also have quantitative tools on there called the Trend Tracker. We do operate as a CTA here in the U.S. as well. So there's information on both of those sides of the business at WeldonLive.com.
Greg, always my pleasure to have you. I and my listeners really appreciate it. And hopefully we can have you back again in the next couple months to discuss how this mess is evolving.
Yeah, well, it should be interesting to see how different things look, you know, a couple months from now, and how right or potentially wrong we were. So, but it's always my pleasure to contribute and participate with you, Jordan.
Coming up next is Jesse Felder. Welcome back, everyone. We are joined by a new guest. Jesse Felder has worked at one of the largest firms on Wall Street, and he was the co-founder of a multi-billion dollar hedge fund firm. You can follow his work at thefelderreport.com. Jesse, first, can you tell us about your philosophy, which you describe as grounded in the tenets of Buffett and kicked up with a notch of inspiration from Paul Tudor Jones? What do you mean by that?
So I started out as just a fundamental value investor, studying, you know, Warren Buffett and Ben Graham's, you know, methods, and that always kind of suited my disposition. But about 10 years ago, I started getting more into technical analysis and trend following and these sorts of things. And I think that, you know, what I've found is the marriage of multiple disciplines is a lot more effective than just one on its own. So I try and combine fundamental analysis, which is really my strong suit, with some technical analysis and trend following and some sentiment stuff on top to try and, you know, have more of a holistic process.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I mean, just to throw in my two cents, I mean, I'm a technical analyst by trade, but that's what someone told me a long time ago, is that you have to look to the fundamentals and technicals and merge them together. Now, first question, Jesse, you've been sharing your concern about the stock market. What currently concerns you the most about U.S. equities?
Well, I think, you know, like we've seen in the past near major market peaks, and I don't know if we're close to one now, but I think investor expectations are, you know, very optimistic. And I think the reality for stocks going forward from current prices is going to be a lot different from what people expect. You know, back in late 1999, Warren Buffett with Carol Loomis wrote kind of an editorial type piece in Fortune explaining that, you know, investors were expecting, you know, 15% a year from the stock market going, you know, going forward from late 1999. And there were all kinds of reasons, and mainly valuations being so high that they were likely to be disappointed. And I find it fascinating that using Buffett's valuation indicator, basically market capitalization to gross national product, stocks today are just as overvalued as they were in November 1999 when he published that piece. Literally, that valuation indicator is just as high as it was back then. So today, you know, there's recently an article in the Wall Street Journal, investor expectations extremely high. They profiled a few advisors. We're talking to some new clients who are literally expecting to generate 20% a year returns going forward in the stock market. And at today's valuations, there's just no possible way to get that. And I think we're closer to having another probably lost decade like we had from 2000 to 2010 is probably far more likely than seeing, you know, the 20% type returns that people are looking for right now. So that's the main thing that I'm concerned about, is I think long-term investors, buy and hold investors, are likely to be really disappointed. That's almost a lock, in my opinion. And then there's also, another potential risk out there, which actually the Fed has outlaid, the San Francisco Fed has put out there, which is basically the risk to valuations from the baby boom generation retiring. And so there's a risk that over the next 10 years, valuations don't just go back to normal levels, but they go down to undervalued levels, because my generation is not nearly as big in terms of population growth as the baby boom generation. And the simple supply and demand is, as you know, the baby boomers are retiring and creating more supply for stock as they position their portfolios more conservatively, my generation is not going to be able to step up and make up enough demand to at least even maintain valuations, let alone keep them as high as they are today. So I think that's a big risk that people aren't even really realizing. What if the stock market becomes undervalued, as it was after the 73-74 bear market and other times in the past? That would mean a painful decline over the next decade. And I think most buy and hold investors think, hey, as long as I'm willing to stay in the market, I'll be made whole at some point, within 2, 3, 4, 5 years. That's been their experience. And there's some possibility out there that could not be the case over this next decade. So that concerns me too.
Now let's move to the technical side and talk about the S&P 500. Is there a certain level there that you're watching that if it breaks, you think would be significant? What levels, if any, do you think our listeners should watch for?
Absolutely. Right now, I think the market looks like it wants to go back down and test the 200-day moving average. And that sits right around the same level as the uptrend line that dates back to 2009. So that's right around, 2019-80-ish. I think the 200 days right at, 2013 right now in the S&P 500. And that uptrend line has been tested a few times over the past year and a half. And it's still been intact, So that uptrend is clearly still legitimate. Now, if we come back down and we test that 200-day moving average again, and we can't hold it this time, that also coincides, like I said, with that long-term uptrend line that dates back to 2009. If that can't hold, I think that's a pretty good signal that we're in for a change in trend.
Okay, now, given your views, Jesse, I would think that you might see opportunity in other markets or asset classes, be it short-term or long-term opportunities. What else out there are you watching that you're more positive on, if anything?
I've been positive on long bonds. I think that, sentiment has been so negative toward long bonds. Everybody has been under this idea that rates have to rise, long-term rates. The Fed may raise short-term rates. I don't think they'll probably get the chance to this year with the weak economic data that's coming in. But everybody's believed this idea that long-term rates have to go up, where when you look around the world and you look at what, our 10-year treasury bond compares to Japanese, German, sovereign yields around the world, one reason why I believe the dollar's been so strong is our rates are still a lot higher than anywhere else around the world. And so, I'm not saying we're going to see 20 basis points on our 10-year treasury like they are in Germany, but that does provide some type of example for what's possible. And so I'm not quite as bullish on long bonds as I have been over the past couple of years, but I think there's still, that might be one of the most hated asset classes out there. And while it's hated, I haven't seen a bull market like that one peak without some type of optimism euphoria. And I don't think that bull run, that trend, will be over until we see that. Having said that, I think right now with the aggressive monetary policy that we're seeing literally all around the globe, mainly, you know, in Japan, but, you know, they're starting QE in Europe. I've been looking to get long gold. Now, from a trading perspective, I've bought it and gotten stopped out, you know, a couple times over the past 2 months. And I'm looking for a trend change there because I think, you know, gold will just be a home run once the central banks realize that even the massive amount of money printing they're doing is not helping very much. We could see, you know, Japanese style money printing, you know, in Europe and here at home. And I think, you know, that's why even Alan Greenspan recently came out and said, it's time to buy gold, you know, which really blew my mind. I have a former Fed chair telling the world it's time to buy gold, you know, when the central banks are doing what they're doing. So those are the alternatives I'm looking at right now.
Yeah, I'm familiar with gold bug circles. I don't always participate in them, but you have to imagine that the people who frequent those circles, they were really pushing that, what Greenspan said. They were happy to hear that, just pushing it on anybody right. who wanted to listen. But before I follow up on precious metals, I want to talk to you a little bit more about long bonds. Jesse, it's so interesting. I'm sure you probably saw the household data as far as the households or their assets in stocks or bonds. And I don't recall, right. I know that stocks are at a major high. You know, they might be at a all-time high, excluding the late 90s. But bonds, they look like in the last couple of years that they've tanked as far as their percentage in a household portfolio. I mean, that it's right. it's so interesting. I agree with you. Many people are saying it's a bubble, but they're not really looking at you know, the ownership data, the sentiment data. So I agree with you there. But it's fascinating to me how how both asset classes, stocks and bonds, have performed really well. Yet it seems like a lot more money has really been pushed into stocks, and maybe a little bit at the expense of bonds. And that being said, bonds have still performed really well. So does that? What are your opinions on that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Sentiment trader Jason Kepford put out an interesting little note yesterday in terms of allocations, and I think it came from the American Association of Individual Investors, and he showed that stock market allocation for individual investors is now just as high as it was, I think, back in 2007. But the allocation to cash is now as low, hasn't been this low since 2000. So people are really aggressively putting money into the stock market. But as you said, yeah, when the Fed's U1 data came out, we saw allocations. It showed the same thing with stocks. We have a very high stock market allocation, households do, but almost a, you know, 20-year low allocation to bonds. You know, mom and pop do not want to own long bonds. They are under this belief that, you know, it's been pounded into them by probably the financial TV, you know, channels, that interest rates are going higher, and so they don't want to be in that asset class. And at the same time, you know, I think it's the Merrill Lynch, you know, fund manager survey showed that, you know, long bonds were their least favorite asset class. So, you know, I said clearly last year, beginning of last year, long bonds were the most hated asset class out there. I don't know if they still are, but they're still not in favor with anybody. And so I think that you're not going to see the end of a bear market, or I'm sorry, a bull market in long bonds like this, without people actually finally embracing it. There's just too many people on the sidelines that haven't yet bought long bonds, which is why I also look at the precedent in, you know, Germany, Japan, and how low their rates are there. People say rates have to go up; they can't go any lower. And I said, well, look how low they are around the world. It's possible. So, I agree with you completely.
Okay, now let me get back to precious metals. Is this just to get, I don't want to get too detailed, but I mean, is your interest in precious metals, I mean, are you, I'm just trying to think how to phrase this question correctly. I mean, I just want to get a little bit more into your thinking. Is this something where you like it because, well, this could be an anti-stock market play? Do you like the long-term fundamentals, or are you thinking about it as a trader that you know, if this starts moving back up because it's been in a bear market, it could be a good trade. Just share a little bit more of your thinking about precious metals, if you can.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll just go through the three things that I look at. Fundamentally, the case for gold for me is just the fact, you know, people have been buying dollars because the other central banks around the world are not quite as our Fed is not quite as crazy as the other central banks around the world. And so they think, let's buy dollars. I think, you know, if our economy continues to slow, we're going to see a new round of QE. We're not going to see rates higher. We're going to see the Fed, you know, pulling out all the stops again. And I think in that environment, this competitive devaluation, you know, between the Japanese and the European Central Bank, and I think the Fed will have to come back in. Then when they're all competitively printing money to see who can print money the fastest, I think, you know, that creates a wonderful fundamental backdrop for the metal. And then in terms, I'm actually looking specifically at the miners, because when you look back over a long period of time, the mining stocks, you know, the total market cap of the mining stocks relative to the metal has never been cheaper. So I think the mining stocks themselves are extremely cheap relative to the metal, too. So I'm looking to play it from the side of the stocks. That's the fundamental side. Sentiment, I think, has gotten really negative. This bear market in gold has really turned people's opinion, and people are very negative on it. And technically, it looks like it's trying to form a base. You know, gold is sitting, has kind of been sitting right at that 61.8% Fibonacci retracement level of the last surge, you know, before it peaked out. And so I think that's a good support level there. And it's been trying to find a base technically now. If it can find a base in here, then that'll be a really good sign. And really the sign I'm looking for is just to see in the metal, you know, once the 50-day moving averages crosses back above the 200-day, that'll be a kind of an all clear for me that it's time to definitely get along gold.
Okay, just a quick follow-up on that. So as far as your trading style, it sounds like you prefer for something to show a little bit of strength before you take a chance. I mean, do you prefer that to buying something when it's just free-falling and the sentiment is off the charts negative?
Yeah, you know, honestly, it's a little bit of both. The value side of me, I love to buy when there's blood, you know, in the streets. In early January, I was buying Herbalife stock, you know, just hand over fist, because Bill Ackman was literally doing everything in his power to shove the stock price lower. And I think that was so that he could get a chance to cover some of his shares. But, you know, that's just total speculation on my part. So I was doing some buying there. You know, if gold does spike down, I'll probably buy a little bit, because there's so much pessimism right now that every time it does seem like it spikes down, it's been a decent buying opportunity. Having said that, for longer term holding, I'd love to see some type of sign that the trend is shifting. The 50 and the 200-day moving average have narrowed since, you know, early February, and a crossing up of that would be a really bullish sign to me that, you know, like I said, an all clear. So, yeah, I'm kind of a hybrid there. I really would like to chance to buy it on some panic, but at the same time, from the longer term perspective, I'd love to see just the trend reverse, and then I could just allocate, you know, a significant portion of my portfolio to the metal and the miners.
Right. And yeah, I'm sorry to circle back here to another topic, but I mean, what are there other asset classes or markets that you're watching? Any specific comments on emerging markets? Because it's been interesting how they've just gone sideways for several years, and the valuations there are so much better than what we have in the U.S. Any thoughts on that asset class or other ones?
Yeah, you know, I've been looking at some of the cheap countries in Europe, I think, you know, and Eastern Europe. Russia and Greece are extremely cheap. Some of the emerging markets, absolutely, like you said, are cheap. What worries me right now about emerging markets has kept me out of that is the strength in the dollar. Every time we've seen this kind of strength in the dollar, we've seen some type of crisis in some emerging market. And, you know, the Bank for International Settlements and some of these other large international organizations have come out and pointed out that a lot of these companies in emerging economies have borrowed an incredible amount of money in U.S. dollars. And so with this 25% surge in the dollar, their principal, you know, of that debt just went up 25%. Their interest payments are up 25%. I can't imagine that there's not going to be some kind of problem that we see arise fairly soon if the dollar doesn't reverse quickly. I got to believe that there's going to be some type of problem in emerging markets creeping up. So I do like the fact that they're cheap, but the currency volatility has kept me away for now.
Okay, now, Jesse, before we close, is there any other topic or thing you want to discuss quickly that we haven't already covered, or anything else you want to mention?
I think, you know, the one thing I haven't heard people talk about, with the latest highs in the stock market, we saw the market move up to new highs in February. We had a divergence, you know, between the Dow Industrials and the Dow Transports. I haven't heard a lot of people talk about that. The other thing is the financials, the bank, big bank stocks, were also unable to make new highs. And so that's a divergence that I've been paying attention to, and a sign that there might be some, you know, under the surface breadth issues with these latest highs in February, and also why I've been expecting another test of the 200-day moving average in that uptrend line. So there's some signs that we could be in for a potential trend change, but I'm waiting for the market to tell me that it's time. So,
Jesse, before we close, can you tell our listeners about how and where they can follow your work and subscribe to your service?
Sure. I've been writing for my own blog for almost 10 years now. It's thefelderreport.com. If you just Google Jesse Felder or Felder Report, it'll come up. Also, I write for Minionville for the Buzz and Banter. Minionville's, you know, just been acquired by T3 Trading, which is a terrific service, too. And then I've also been writing for Yahoo Finance contributors. So, but all of it goes through my blog, and I kind of update my thoughts about the markets and some other things there.
Jesse, thanks so much for joining us today. I and my listeners really appreciate it, and hopefully we can have you back again in the next couple months so you can chat about new developments in the markets.
I'd love to, Jordan. Thanks for having me.
That's all for this week. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you're having a great Easter weekend. And I wish you good health and good profits in the week ahead. And hopefully we'll see you back here again next week.